Hello. Can you hear? Is this on? Is on? It's on?
Testing.
Yeah. Excellent. You shut the door, actually. Okay. Is it 6 o'clock? Yeah. Good evening and welcome to this evening's talk of the Stapleton Actuarial Society. My name is not Natania Rolofsky. She is delayed on the train, so I'm stepping in. My name is Samir Shet. I'm part of the committee. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next program talk will be on the CMI Mortality Projections Model on Tuesday, 2nd of April. Further details and online registration are available on SIAS's website. For this particular talk, we are also, for the first time, trialing a live webinar. Details of this will also be on the website in due course. The SIAS poker tournament will take place on Thursday, 7th of March. We have also organized a board games event on 30th of April to take you back down memory lane. Further details and tickets for this event are available on our website as well. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join SIAS. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for IFOA fellows and £12 for IFOA students. Further details are provided on our website. There's an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign in on your way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get added automatically to your CPD, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible, and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk. Please take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. There's some seat just at the front. If the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. Finally, a reminder to switch your mobiles to silent, please. Tonight's talk will last around 1 hour and be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talks, so there's a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and another for best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA. Please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. Following the meeting, there'll be snacks and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall. Please do join us. Back to tonight's talk. Our speakers are Lisa Balboa and Alex Hanks. Lisa works as an actuarial pricing consultant at Bupa and is co-chairing the regulations and ethics workstream of the data science MIG. Lisa has an MSc in international health policy and is passionate about exploring opportunities for actuaries to contribute to the healthcare sector. As an active contributor to the IFOA's health and care practice area, Lisa has authored and presented research on topics including embedding wearable health tech into insurance and using predictive analytics to improve healthcare demand forecasting. In her spare time, Lisa enjoys swimming and playing the occasional game of Harry Potter Trivial Pursuit. Alex is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and head of actuarial and analytics at Price Forbes. He was previously a senior manager in Ernst & Young's insurance risk and actuarial services team and between 2005 and 2015 held increasingly senior roles at XL Group, now AXA XL, including reinsurance chief actuary and Latin America and the Caribbean. Alex is a graduate of Cambridge University with a MA in mathematics and a postgraduate diploma in computer science. Despite having no natural talent at all for learning foreign languages, Alex insists on continuing to try. This regularly results in unfortunate mistakes, such as him over-ordering in bars and restaurants when his Spanish 4, cuatro, is mistakenly understood to be an 8, ocho. So thank Lisa first.
Stand there, does the mic work fine? Perfect. Thanks for that introduction, Samir. So the topic I'm going to talk to you all about today is using predictive analytics to improve healthcare demand forecasting, and going to look in particular at challenges and opportunities for us as actuaries in this space. So I thought before we get started, I'd let you do some work and maybe just a quick show of hands for who here at the moment uses predictive analytics in their day job. So a few, probably about 5% of the room. So I'll contrast this then with a recent survey by the Society of Actuaries in the United States, and it shows that 47% of healthcare payers and providers in the US, so this was a survey of about 250 healthcare payers and providers there, so about half of them are already using predictive analytics, and for those that aren't, another 42% plan to be using these techniques over the coming few years. So I think there's a real opportunity. It's a very big growing market. So that sort of brings me on to the agenda for today and why we're here, which is to look at what challenges and opportunities we have as actuaries to help scale up some of these uses. So for sort of 25, 30 minutes of my talk, I'll give a brief overview of what predictive analytics is, particularly for sort of majority in the room that aren't familiar with using predictive analytics. And I'll then go on to look at four specific examples of how predictive modeling is already being used in the healthcare space. And then I'll use that to draw on some of the bigger challenges and opportunities for us as actuaries. And although the examples are health and care, sort of aware that not everyone here will be working in the health and care practice area. So I think there'll be a lot of parallels that you can also draw for your own practice areas in terms of doing predictive modeling and starting to build on and improve these techniques. So starting off then with a brief overview of predictive analytics. So I'll keep this quite high level. And so in really simple terms, predictive analytics is no more complex than just using historical data to make predictions about future unknowns. So I think there's two sort of broad categories. Supervised learning is probably familiar to a lot more people here in this room. So you have your pre-specified input variables, you have your defined target output variable, and then you look at the relationships between them. And you'll make a lot more defined judgments and assumptions about the relationship between your input variables on the one hand and your output variables on the other hand. So multivariate regression, that would fit into this category here. And then what we have, which is the sort of more up-and-coming category that probably a lot of you are interested in hearing more about, is the unsupervised learning processes. So these don't make predefined assumptions about the structure and relationships within the data, but rather what you have is you have these attribute-based algorithms that can identify clusters and associations within the data. So rather than predefining what input variables you think might be predictive up front, you actually use your algorithms to iteratively work out what those key attributes are. And a subset of this then is responsive reinforcement learning algorithms. So this will actually allow the model to dynamically update as new data emerges. So although a particular input or attribute might not be predictive initially, the landscape might change, particularly in the context of something like health and care, where you've got medical advances or you've got new diseases and threats emerging. What you have then is the ability to dynamically update your model to redefine those structures and relationships within the data, re-identify some clusters and associations, and that increased flexibility is really valuable in a context such as the health and care space. So I thought I'd contextualize this just with sort of the six steps of what I think a predictive analytics process would look like if you're trying to forecast a patient's need for healthcare, so trying to work out what treatment they might need. So I'll focus in more on the first step, and then sort of the later steps, we'll sort of see some of these through the examples, and also Alex's talk will look at some sort of the steps of developing a model. He's got some code to share with us as well. So the first step then is obtaining your training data, and this is really important. You obviously need your data, your historic data, so you can start to build your model. And in the health and care space, I've sort of categorized this into three main key data sources. So you've got your health service data, so that would be things like your admissions records for patients coming into the hospital, discharge data as well when patients are exiting, so that's typically quite structured data, electronic medical records about your patients as well. And then you're also seeing some less structured data that can start to be used in modeling. So using things like x-rays or MRIs and building that into your model as well is a real opportunity that's coming up. So the second category then is what I like to call everyday data. So it's taking people and looking at them not only while they're in the health service, but what you do as you go about your everyday life. So maybe using a wearable tracker to monitor your activity, mobile apps, even social media, for example, people reporting that they or their friends are sick, wishing them well. That can all be used potentially to develop your healthcare model. And then thirdly is genomic data, which is sort of an even more up-and-coming data set, but there's quite a strong focus in the UK at the moment in developing this data set. So towards the second half of last year, we saw the launch of the NHS Genomic Medicine Service. So that's focused on sequencing 1 million human genomes in order to start to develop things like personalized medical treatment based on using your genes to predict what treatments are going to be most effective. So those are sort of the categories of data that you could use for your training data set. And of course, these are all going to be really large data sets. So you're going to need a lot of computing power, maybe clusters of computers to do your processing, maybe things like parallel processing. So you're going to need a lot of new techniques in order to be able to sort of obtain that data, store that data, transform that data into a usable format. So once you do have that data, then you're able to start to develop those algorithms that we talked about on the slide before. So running your algorithms to work out those clusters and associations within the data that are going to be predictive of a patient's need for healthcare. So you can develop those algorithms, and then you could obviously test them on your past data, and you can use a holdout sample in order to hold back part of the data in order to then test the validity of the model that you've built. But then once you have built that model and you're confident enough that this is a good first starting point, you can then move on to apply it to patient data, so data from those patients for whom you wish to forecast their future demand for healthcare and the future medical treatments that they might need. So it's really important, obviously, when you collect that case data, that you're collecting those attributes that you found to be predictive in step two. So maybe you need all those fields of your electronic medical records that you found to be predictive for the types of medical treatment that they're going to undertake, or other factors that might be as simple as things like age and gender of the patient as well. So you want to collect all of that in your case data, but you might not want to throw out all the other attributes. So you can see it's quite an iterative process. So things that weren't predictive in your initial iteration might be predictive in later cycles of the model. So you might not want to just only collect the data on those key attributes that you've identified as being predictive, but you will want to have a wider set of attributes there. And then what you can do is apply the model to forecast the patient's need for particular medical treatments. So sort of work out what probability the patient will recover from certain medical treatments, for example, or the probability that they'll present to the different forms of the health service, primary care or secondary care, whatever you've specified your model to do. And then the doctor will apply their recommendations, probably initially. Of course, the doctor will be blind to the model, so the model wouldn't necessarily be recommending the treatment, but you can then look in step six how what you predicted from the model compares with what actually happened in practice, what treatments that the patient underwent and things like that. And then you can use that to retrain your model, refine your model, and improve it going forwards as well. So appreciate that's quite high level, but I've got four examples that I'm going to share with you to sort of draw out some of the details of this and sort of put it into real life examples. And of course, use those examples to highlight the challenges and opportunities for us as actuaries here today to look at what we can do going forward to overcome some of these challenges and opportunities and use predictive analytics. So the first challenge and opportunity then is to do with recognizing and overcoming limitations to do with the data and the predictive modeling process. So I've got two examples that I'd like to talk through, and then we'll talk about the challenges and opportunities. So the first example comes from Australia, and it's a patient admission prediction tool. So some researchers in Australia, they've built a model that can forecast hospital occupancy levels. And the way they've done that is they've used 10 years worth of admissions data, and they've combined that data with other data sources like times of the year when a winter flu outbreak is most likely, factors such as that. And they've built quite a powerful model. So the model that they've built, they've used it in 27 hospitals in Queensland, Australia, and they're able to actually predict admissions, arrivals at hospital, down to the hour by things like gender, medical condition, severity. And that's been really valuable. So the hospital bed managers have been able to plan their resources for the coming week based on those forecasted occupancy levels. So you can really adjust your staffing in line with what you predict demand at the hospital is going to be. And of course, there's been some really big interest in the National Health Service in scaling up this model to apply it wider, so you could predict spikes in demand across the entire health service and potentially take measures to respond proactively to that to prevent things like bottlenecks and overcrowding in the system as well. And I've got a nice schematic later on towards the end of the presentation that will sort of visualize some of that as well. So that's the first example. And then the second example is around managing chronic conditions. So the first example used health service data as its source. This example uses everyday data. So it's looking at data from mobile apps and wearables. And what the Poole NHS Foundation Trust have done in collaboration with Microsoft is that they've built this MyCare-centric app for people with epilepsy. And by analysing the data from their sleep, exercise, heart rate, as they go about their everyday lives, the doctors are able to remotely contact the patient when the algorithm predicts that that patient's risk of epilepsy is going to be very high. So you can do proactive response measures, for example, automedication or take other intervention measures. And that's managed to reduce epilepsy-related hospital admissions. So there's a real opportunity to actually use some of this technology and this predictive modelling in order to improve the management of chronic conditions as well. So in terms of specific challenges and opportunities for actuaries, and I think these will apply whether you're working in healthcare or larger fields, of course you need to recognise the limitations of your predictive models. So that's pretty fundamental, particularly when you're starting out in the early stages of developing a model. So for example, in the case of the Australian example, the patient admission prediction tool, you might have some missing data. So they used 10 years worth of admissions data. So you're quite likely to have a lot of inconsistencies in that data. Your data might not be in the most appropriate format. If you're using things like electronic medical records data, there might have been description that's been added over time that's lacking in your earlier data sets. So you really need to be aware of the quality of the data that you're working with, and also the reliability of the data and the model that you've built. So in the case of that patient admission prediction tool, it needs at least 10 admissions per day to the hospital to actually get a reliable forecast. So it's important that obviously hospital bed managers are aware of that so that they don't misplan their resources based on unreliable output from the model. And also the MyCare-centric epilepsy app looked really promising, but at the moment it's on a very small scale. So there were only 50 people enrolled in that trial. So it will be about scaling up the use of that model once you've got your initial samples, then take that wider to see if you need to further develop your model because you're going to have potentially different risk profiles of patients, different attributes of patients that might not all behave like those 50 people in the Poole NHS Foundation Trust. So of course it's important to be aware then of that reliability of the data. And then a really interesting one in health and care is this selection bias. So you might not just want to use an off-the-shelf machine learning algorithm in this sort of context. So in healthcare, you can have some quite strong selection biases to take account of. So if you think there's actually been some studies that have been done that show the fact that a patient underwent a particular test is more predictive than the result of that test itself in the model, which is probably not ideal. So it might suggest selection bias, like the sickest patients are presenting for testing, for example, or maybe that test is really invasive and doctors are only using that test to confirm a very severe diagnosis. So it's really important to be aware of the landscape and the context of what you're working with and not just use variables that, for example, a doctor could have told you that result. That test is always used to diagnose that particular condition, so you're not going to have any merit in using it in your predictive model. And of course, you need a model that we talked about earlier that's flexible and adaptable to new medical threats and diseases as well, so making sure you have that iterative modeling process so that the model stays relevant going forwards. So I guess as actuaries, I think we have a real opportunity to help overcome some of these limitations. We're used to working with some quite large quantities of data and calling out those judgments, assumptions, and limitations. So we could really help to advise on improving the quality and the reliability of the data that we collect, maybe helping to develop some of those healthcare specific algorithms as well, so not just taking off-the-shelf machine learning solutions, but working with stakeholders to develop algorithms that are suitable for health and care or the particular problem that you're trying to model. And then, of course, quantifying and communicating that uncertainty in the results. For example, you might need a certain number of people to present to the health system before you have a reliable forecast, things like that. So the next example then I'd like to use to demonstrate the real big opportunity of predictive modeling of cost and efficiency savings, then also touch on one of the key challenges of data privacy, which is obviously a key concern, and I'll try and relate this specifically to some of the health and care issues because it's quite a broad topic. So for this example, focusing on the United States and their Veterans Health Administration system. So this is the largest health system in the United States. And what they've actually been able to do is build this data warehouse. So they've centralized more than 30 years worth of electronic medical records data in their data warehouse. And it costs a huge amount to develop. So it cost about an estimated $1 billion to develop. But it has allowed a cumulative net return over time, which is great. And I guess there's a few ways they've achieved that. So you've got the really sort of basic advantage, I like to call it. It's not a modeling specific advantage, but just by pooling this data together, if you have an individual that goes to one hospital, has a test, goes home, falls ill, presents at a different hospital, you can then access the result of that previous test in the system. So you can make some basic cost savings by not rerunning tests and getting to a diagnosis quicker if the patient presents at a different hospital. So you've got a coordinated system. And then more importantly, in terms of predictive modeling, is that they've been able to centralize this data and use it to develop algorithms. So you can develop these algorithms to predict things like mortality risk, risk of hospitalization, risk of developing complications, and that's really valuable. So the frontline care managers can actually use these predictive patient risk scores to guide their treatment and improve the efficiency in the way that they deliver care as well. So cost savings is not unique to only this particular example in the US. So that survey I mentioned at the start, there's the majority believe that predictive analytics could enable future cost savings of more than 25% over a five-year period. So there's a real opportunity here to use predictive analytics to improve not only the quality of care delivered, but also the cost and efficiency savings that can be gained from investing in this as well. So for the next challenge then, data privacy. I've talked quite a bit about health service data in that example, but then as we start to introduce things like mobile data, wearables data into modeling, the data privacy challenges become much larger. So I thought I'd just do another quick poll, show of hands for who in this room would be comfortable sharing their wearables and mobile app data with their doctor or a member of their health team, so maybe they could help diagnose you better or things like that. That's quite good. It's probably about 90% or so, seemed like most people. And now, second show of hands, if you'd be willing to share that same data with your employer. Any brave people? Yeah, I've got one or two people put their hand up there. So contrast this then with the survey we'll compare it to. We might be a bit less trusting than the national average in this room. Maybe we know what data can or can't be used for here. But we found that 90% of those surveyed would be happy to share that mobile and wearables app data with their doctor. So, of course, if you share it with your medical team, you'd think, well, probably I'll get to a diagnosis quicker. They might be able to use it in enhancing my care. But only 38% would share that same data with their employer. And then another different survey here, but although the majority of people surveyed would be willing to share their genomic data with medical professionals, health researchers, 95% would not share their genomic data with a private company. So that would include employers, insurers, things like that. So you can see people are quite particular about who they want to access different types of their data. So people have a real need to be able to control who they let access the different types of their health and lifestyle data. So in terms of a potential solution to this data privacy challenge then, you can envisage something like a personal health record being set up, so allowing the individual to actually be put in the center of their data, so maybe you can control via an app on your phone who can access exactly which parts of your mobile data, maybe secured by something like blockchain type technology or something a bit more secure than that. But what you can do is you could not only allow people to access your name data, but you could potentially also elect to anonymize that data, feed it into larger research programs, let health service providers collate that data to do their demand forecasts, and you really have that opportunity to be in control of who can access exactly what parts of your data and when. And of course, you'll get your own potentially personal benefits from this. So maybe quicker diagnosis, recommendation of preventative healthcare measures, things like that. So in terms of the final example then, the fourth example, I'd like to look at then maybe pooling some of this data. So if you can overcome that data privacy challenge, you could start to pool all these different data sources together in order to improve predicting demand across the health system. So I thought I'd show you a quick 2-minute, 3-minute video that's actually pooling data from quite an unusual source. So this is pooling NASA satellite system weather forecast data alongside other data such as population density data and access to things like clean water in order to predict risk of cholera outbreak in different locations around the world.
Decades of research and technology have allowed for better forecasting of the when, where, and how intense a hurricane will be. But what if we could predict a disease outbreak in the wake of a storm? That's the question some researchers asked about cholera in Haiti in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. Cholera is a waterborne infectious disease that occurs when a person ingests food or water contaminated with the Vibrio bacterium. Cholera causes severe diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, and dehydration, and can lead to death if untreated. Researchers estimate that hundreds of thousands of cases are reported each year worldwide.
The bacterium is found in world oceans globally, especially in the temperate regions and in the tropics. So in the countries less developed, with infrastructure that is not the equivalent, let's say, of Europe or the United States or Canada, then the population that has to rely on river water, pond water, is at risk for cholera.
In addition to water insecurity, high seasonal temperatures followed by extreme rainfall, concentrated populations, and a natural disaster are all conditions conducive to a cholera epidemic. This was the case for Haiti in 2010.
The data that we were able to pull together showed that in 2010, it was the hottest summer in 50 years. And then, as if that weren't enough, there was a hurricane that skirted the island, but it dumped the heaviest rainfall in 50 years.
We tried to make an algorithm in a cohesive form to determine the risk. And then that basically provided us with the first clues on the risk of outbreak of cholera in Haiti after this earthquake. Then we used the same algorithm with improved satellite data sets from Global Precipitation Measurement Mission after Hurricane Matthew struck that region again. And we were able to, in real time, predict the risk of cholera infection in human population at least 4 weeks in advance. We did the same thing for Yemen. We knew that there is a mass movement of human population due to civil unrest in that part of the world. And then we had very heavy precipitation. And then we immediately started monitoring conditions. And that basically converged to give us a risk on where and when this disease will occur in human population.
I think we can predict and prevent, and I'd like to see that happen very quickly in the next 3 to 5 years. And I'd like to see the satellite system to be part of the regular public health tools so that we can do prediction as well as the tracking of epidemics that's done traditionally now.
Hopefully that gave you a taste of sort of what's possible if you start to pull these different data sources together. So in that particular video, by pooling all these different data inputs together, they're actually able to predict the risk of cholera outbreak up to 4 weeks in advance. So that's long enough for you to start to target health workers to those particular areas with a high risk of a cholera outbreak being imminent. So you can target, for example, sanitation advice and chlorine tablets, not only to forecast that epidemic, but also to help prevent it and limit the spread of the epidemic as well. And if you can start to improve that model, further refine that model, maybe include more data sources in that to extend the prediction window up to 8 weeks, that's the point at which you could also target vaccination campaigns, because the vaccines will take a while to work. So that's quite an exciting opportunity there as well. And there's quite a lot of interest to extending this model to other regions, other diseases as well. So in terms of the challenges then, pooling that data together isn't necessarily straightforward. So you have a lot of large data sets that aren't interoperable and don't mesh together. So the challenge then is to create data that's going to be exchangeable across the whole health service, either internationally to predict outbreaks of disease or in the context of, for example, a national health system to predict when patients are going to arrive at the hospital. So in terms of having data that's exchangeable across the health service, you might want to have a common programming language, a common data storage language, things like that. So you've got projects like the FAST Healthcare Interoperability Resources Specification Project that are working on defining those standards internationally. And we're seeing the NHS, for example, putting in their targets, their desire to actually work towards complying with those standards so that you can start to exchange all this different data, not just health service data, but also wearables data, mobile app data, maybe things like weather data across the health system to improve the forecasting of demand for healthcare. So finally then, there's a real opportunity if you're able to pull this data together in order to help forecast demand for health across the system and also to plan your resources. So I've got a diagram here that's a quite crude schematic of maybe a health service. You've got your primary and your community care, so you know your GP, and then you've got your secondary care and tertiary care, so your specialised hospital care, your A&E, all over there. So if you are able to pull that data together and make that resource forecast and predict when you're going to see spikes in demand, for example, maybe it's a winter flu outbreak season and you're seeing demand spiking, you could then respond proactively to that. So you could discharge your lowest risk, your most clinically stable patients back into primary and community care under the supervision of their local doctor. And that would free up resources to actually cope with those critically ill patients. So you can really match your resources to your demand need. And there's some other benefits as well. So if you are using that personal health record as an input data source, you might have pulled together your mobile data, your wearables data, all that information about you, that when you come to need healthcare, it could triage you more effectively, for example, into secondary care if it's a very severe condition that's being predicted, or to primary care if it's predicted to be a less acute condition. And so you can, again, move people around that system according to their clinical needs and the capacity as well. And of course, for those not needing any care, you can also use that data source to monitor individuals, maybe recommend preventative health measures to decrease their risk of getting sick going forwards as well. So there's a lot of value that if you are able to start to pull this data together to do predictive modelling of who's going to need what sort of healthcare and when, you can then start to improve the resource planning of your system and also improve the quality of care delivered to get the right treatment to the patient at the right time. So quick conclusion then, just in terms of the potential opportunities for actuaries. So I think these will apply to healthcare, but also a lot of these will apply generally to wider practice areas. So we can, as actuaries, help build highly responsive models, combining those different data sources together, helping to develop that big data infrastructure to cope with your large data sets, and also applying your machine learning or healthcare-specific algorithms or problem-specific algorithms, rather than using off-the-shelf learning solutions necessarily. A big role in risk management, so highlighting those data quality risks, ensuring data privacy compliance, and also quantifying and helping to reduce uncertainty in the output of that model, so making sure that you have enough people in your sample and things like that. And then finally, actually helping stakeholders to use those models. So it's all very well building a model, but we need to be able to interpret it and communicate it back to those people, for example, that are going to make your resourcing decisions in health and care. So that will allow, ultimately, the ability to then allocate your healthcare resources according to clinical need, but also taking into account the forecasted capacity constraints of the health service as well. Thank you very much. And I think Alex will talk next, but I'll be happy to take questions in the Q&A later after Alex's presentation as well.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay, yeah, so first of all, apologies, everyone. My slides have no videos and just hundreds of lines of boring Python code, so I'll do my best to keep everyone awake. Basically, what I'm going to talk about today is I guess, an example of why I think data science is becoming massively relevant for us as actuaries, even in, I suppose, my world of general insurance, the reinsurance, where we typically don't have very big data sets and we think, you know, there's not much we can do. I guess my challenge would be to people to think about where you can do things and we'll start to see the ways things are starting to change in our world. So what I'm going to talk about is curve fitting. So this is if you're building a sort of a frequency severity model for whatever you're doing, capital modeling, maybe you're doing pricing. You're often going to need to fit a curve, typically like a probability distribution curve, to your data. And there's ways we've done that in the past. But so here I'm going to explore another way you could do that. And it's got some advantages and some disadvantages. And this is pretty experimental. And I think maybe I could get to the point where I could use it on real client work in the future, but it's not there yet. And I've done everything, as I say, in Python. I've used what it's called the Jupyter Notebook. I don't know if anyone's heard of that, but if you haven't, I'd say go and check them out. It's a really powerful tool where you can mix code and text, and you can describe what you're doing in a very easy-to-share way, like a notebook way, which I guess data scientists have been doing for a while, and maybe there's something there we can learn as actuaries. And all the code's online if you want to go and have a look and download it and play with it. So what are we going to be doing? Well, there's sort of five steps to this. Going to be generating some random curves, and I'm going to be using Bezier curves, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Going to be creating a synthetic data set. So this idea that there's not enough data in general insurance, so maybe we can do something to create some data sets to train some models. And then I'm just going to be training a regression neural network using this data, and then using it once it's trained to sort of come up with predictions. And then just talking a little bit about some of the strengths, limitations, and perhaps other things you could do with this approach to extend it. So there's going to be code, and I'm just going to ignore it and not talk about it. You'll see it coming up every now and again. If you're interested, you know, by all means, dig into it. So curve fitting. So, yeah, I mean, as I say, we use them in our Monte Carlo models in general insurance. We treat breakout the frequency and severity separately, and we often need to come up with a smooth curve to describe a set of discrete losses that we've got. And we might use things like Pareto, log normal, beta, gamma, or whatever other distributions. But essentially, they're sort of families of distributions with fairly rigid shapes. So it's sort of shape fitting. And, you know, they look like this sort of thing. There's a few examples just there. Again, just generated on the fly, a few random ones. But there are a few sort of issues with curve fitting in general that, you know, when you work with them for a while, you come across. you typically use sort of maximum likelihood estimation to kind of parameterize these things. But often you need some level of judgment to perhaps select the distribution family that might be appropriate. So you might have some claims data, but you know, should you use a log normal? Maybe this is more like casualty Pareto type stuff. Maybe it's something else. So there's a certain amount of judgment as to where you start. Or you could just try everything, and then you could try and use like a least squares or something to compare them to find out which one fits best. But you know, it's starting to get quite a lot of work, and there's different ways you could say which one fits better in which part of the curve. There's issues around, you know, some of these distributions are on a fixed interval and others are unbounded. Depending on what you want to do, that might be complicated. And sometimes real-world data is just messy and it just doesn't look like any of these one distributions, and you might need to splice some together or do something else. So there's specific issues there. So then I was thinking, well, what, you know, if I could have something that would make my life a bit easier, what might it look like? And this is kind of what I came up with. So I'd want something which is a, you know, you could describe it with just a few parameters. I like severity values in the range 0 to 1, so that if I've got a policy exposure amount, I can just apply it as a sort of a damage ratio, if you like, to kind of work on different exposed amounts. It'd be nice not to really have to know too much about the underlying distribution families and make decisions about whether it should be this one or that one. And it'd be nice if it was a sort of one size fits all in a sense, or more of a universal function. Now, this is a bit of a wish list. And you know, being able to pull out simple statistics off these things, perhaps having, and maybe 6 is quite key, having some sort of measurement of the confidence of the fit from the distribution as well. So that's the kind of a wish list. So that's kind of what I had in mind as I went through this. So taking the next step then, Bezier curves, and what are they? They've been around for a while, but mostly in car design or design. They're easy to work with if you're trying to come up with a smooth curve. If you go on Google and put in Bezier curves, you can find some sort of interactive JavaScript things where you can drag Bezier curve handles around and see how your shape of your curve responds. So they're quite intuitive to use, and I guess that's why they've been so popular in the world of design. And some people have started to link them through to statistics. I've not done an in-depth study on that, but there's interesting work there. And this is just the formula that I'm using. So it's a parametric distribution. It's got 4 points, so P0, P1, P2, P3, which are just XY vectors. But we're going to set 2 of them fixed, so we're going to use 0, 0, and 1, 1. So it really leaves us with four free parameters that we're going to be messing around with. And so then I've got, again, a load of more code just to start to generate these curves and using a bisection method to look up on the curve, because they're parametric curves and I want to go between the X and the Y. So I need a way to bisect to find the X given a Y and so on. More code. So then here's the first. All that code is doing is generating some random Bezier curves, basically. And this is one that's generated. So you can see these red dots are the handles of the Bezier curve. So as you move those red dots around, the shape of the curve is going to change. The one on the bottom left and the top right are fixed, so you've got the 2 points you can move. And if you move them around, you can get quite different curves. So these two on the right are the sort of the extremes. If you move your handles to the top left and the top right, bottom right, so in that, you get a more of an S-shaped curve. And the other ones are kind of just random, a couple more random ones, which, you know, not quite linear, but somewhere offline. And so if you randomly select P1s and P2s anywhere within that sort of space, that 0 to 1, 0 to 1, you're going to get a different shape curve out. But they kind of fit with this sort of shape overall, which is a bit like a sort of a distribution function shape. So that's why I've chosen them. They've got a nice property that they kind of easy to work with, and they sort of give you shapes which kind of look like distribution functions. So, like I say here, they're well defined on 0 and 1. They're smooth, they're monotonically increasing if you're careful about how you choose P1 and P2. And so essentially from now on, then, rather than thinking about them as curves, you're going to be thinking about them as CDFs. So now that we've got a function that can make, you know, can create some random curves, we're going to create a whole load of them. As in sort of tens of thousands. As well as just creating the curve, what we're going to be doing, because we're going to be using them as cumulative distribution functions, we're going to be sampling from them. So we're going to say, okay, well, I want to pick like 10 random points off my curve, assuming you know, between 0 and 1, random pick, what's my x value for that random pick, and so on. So I'm creating sort of sampled loss data from the curve. So these next set of functions are just doing that. And so this one says, I want to create number of Bezier, so maybe 100 curves, a number of samples, maybe 500, and that will give me a data set with up to 500 random samples from each of the 100 Bezier curves, so you know, 500 times 100. And here I've just created four different curves with 50 samples on each, so you should get up to 50, so up to 50 green dots, but it's randomly choosing the number of samples up to 50. And then I'm just sorting the samples in ascending to descending order so that they start to line up against the curve. And if you do this often enough, they should tie up to the curve. But this gives a way of creating a synthetic data set. So rather than running it with 4 and 50, what we're now going to do is create a sort of a training data set, which is doing exactly the same thing but at a bigger scale. So here taking 500,000 curves and with 500 samples on each of them. So when you run this, it takes quite a while, and it creates a few gigabytes of data, and it dumps it onto file. But it gives us something that we can then start to train a neural network on. So what we're doing is really just creating a, and I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on neural networks, but for the purpose of this, if you just think about it as approximating a function. So we've got a whole load of inputs, which are our sampled data. And then we've got an output, which is just the Bezier parameters. So we're going to give this neural network all of these examples. So here's 500 loss points, and here are the Bezier parameters that I created that with. And here's another one, and here's another one. And do that hundreds of thousands of times, and teach the neural network how to approximate that function that we already know. And so that's what you'll see in this rather badly drawn neural network that I've done here. So at the top, you've got the 500 inputs, which are the green sort of sample data. And at the bottom, you've got the four outputs, which are the P1 and the P2, the X and Y of each of those. And in the middle, I've just got the sort of guts of the neural network, which are just the weights and that it's going to fit to as we train it. But I won't get into that bit. So I've trained it all using TensorFlow, which is a sort of a Google machine learning library in Python. Because it's quite memory intensive, I've broken it into pieces, and it does it in chunks. But again, that's sort of getting into the computation, so I won't get too sidetracked by that. And I'm going to go through the training set quite a few times because it still continues to learn even after the sort of first cycle. You go through the training set a number of times and you're still getting improvements in it's still learning the function. This is an output screenshot from TensorBoard, which is sort of showing you the learning curves. So what you're seeing here is for a whole bunch of different models, because I ran a few different configurations to try to come up with something that would learn a bit faster. This is not systematically done, and it's not there's probably more optimal solutions, more optimal configurations, and so on. But essentially, as these curves start out on the on the left, they don't know anything. They've just seen the data for the first time. The errors are huge when you're testing how well they're doing. And then as you give them more and more samples, they start to get better at what they're doing. And you can see that the error is dropping over time with the samples. So by the time you're out, right on the far side, and you've got whatever it is, 1.6 million, with each of those has got about 20 samples in, so 1.6 times 20. It's still actually going down a little bit, but much more gradually now, and I think I just gave up running it at that point, not having infinite computing time. But you can see it's the learning curve is doing what it's meant to do, which is go down over time. These are actually mixing together training sets. Some of those lines are training and some of them are validating. So the data set's been split into two, with only part of it's being used for the training, part of it's just being used as I go along to see how well it's doing on the untrained data set. Essentially, once you've done that, you've basically found a whole bunch of weights for your neural network, which when you then put in inputs, it will give you predictions or outputs for the Bezier curves. And so this is just a function that does that. So it takes those train parameters, and now it's ready to take as inputs some sample data and tell you what it thinks your curve might look like that would best fit those data points. And And so this is what it starts to look like. So this is just some new data, new sample data that I created. It's got nothing to do with any of the training data we use, although it is coming from Bezier curves as well. So it's not given anything more challenging than that. And I've just created a few examples where I've given it, I think, 500 sample data points, and I've shown the green points then are the sample data, the random data, and then the blue curve is what it's come up with as it's fit to the data. And the red dots being the handles that correspond to the blue curve. And underneath, I've shown the predicted and the actual P1s and P2s for those ones. So you can see it's kind of, when you look at, I mean, the curves aren't too bad. They're not great, room for improvement. But some of the predictions and some of the actuals are actually quite far apart, but it's still kind of getting there more or less. So there's definitely room to optimize the way it's fitting. But it's kind of doing what you want it to do, right? You're giving it data points, and it's roughly fitting a curve that looks pretty smooth to those data points. So I think it's the first step. So I'd say we've got the basic model that we can start to do something more with in the next step. And so start to put together some future steps to turn this into something a bit more practical. First thing, I think, is to sort of test prediction using some other sample distributions. So let's sample some data from a log normal and give it that and see how well it fits to that data. Let's start to kind of give it a few more challenging examples to see how well it's learned. And real data. I could probably try it on some confidential real data, but I couldn't really show it here. And then optimize its learning ability. So I think there's definitely more to be done there. I think you can quite quickly get to a pretty smooth fit, especially on this sort of data, if you optimized a bit more. But there's a lot to play with in that sort of space. There's obviously quite a lot of limitations with this, so I'm not trying to present it as a perfect, universal curve-fitting solution, not at this point. But I think things like skewed data. I mean, a lot of the distributions we deal with can be quite extreme-tail distributions. I don't know how well this is going to cope with that kind of thing. Probably not that well when you go think back to the sort of initial S-shape curves you saw on the Bezier examples. You might need more extreme distributions in there, and there's ways you could potentially do that. And one way might be, if you wanted to stick with Bezier, you could move your handles outside of that 0-1 range and put them somewhere else, and then you can start to get effectively any shape curve. You'd have to filter that to take out any curves which weren't kind of a cumulative distribution function, so any that weren't monotonically increasing, things like that. But there's ways that you could augment that data set. Another thing you could do is just to bin the choice of Bezier. I mean, this kind of method would work with anything, really. You could do the same thing with, you could create a Frankenstein set of inputs. You could start to blend together your log normals and your Paretos and come up with some weird input training set that was sort of stitching together different distributions and just teach your neural network how to approximate based on that weird input set, in the hope that when it then comes across real world data, it might do a better job of fitting distributions which have one shape in one part of the curve and another shape somewhere else. So there's kind of other things you could do in how you sort of train your function fitter, if you like, if you want to think of it that way. And again, I've stuck with this idea of using sort of 0 to 1 as the severity, but there might be cases where you don't want to do that or it doesn't make sense. You might be interested in unlimited liability stuff or, examples where that's just not going to be appropriate. So, the strengths of it, I guess I'm thinking back to that kind of wish list of things which I wanted to try to get, I'd argue that you've to some extent, you've kind of ticked off 1 to 4 on there. We've work to be done, but 5, I think, simple methods of getting like means and statistical summaries and so on. With numerical methods, they're so powerful now that you could pretty quickly get them from the algorithm or get them from the Bezier function without any problems. I say that one's done. I think the 6 one's actually probably the most interesting, which is this idea of allow measurement of the confidence in the goodness of fit. And this is something that I just want to talk about on the last slide. And I haven't done any work on that here, although I have on other examples. But it's technically possible to extract from the neural network its kind of confidence in its own predictions, which I think is where it could get really useful. So, you know, it's told you, I think this is your P1, your P2, these are the handle values. But yeah, how confident is it in its, you know, you gave it two data points, how happy is it that that's the right answer? It's going to give you an answer, but there's also a confidence around that you can get out. And one way to do that is to switch from using a regression neural network and actually use a classifier neural network. So this is just rather than regressing to a single point, we could say, okay, I want to run exactly the same exercise again. This time I'm just going to focus on, say, the X value of P1, and I want to know what the X value of P1 might look like. And I'm going to say, let's classify it between, in bands of 100, between 0 and 1, say, you know, 0.01 to 0.02 to 0.03. So I've broken up my continuous space into 100 discrete spaces and run it as a classifier to say, what's the probability that that value is in this band or this band or this band or this band? And if you train it in exactly the same way that we've done here, but so you'd be training it on pre-classified inputs and looking at the output, you can actually get out a probability distribution. So you'd have it would be fairly discrete. You'd only have 100. In that case, you'd have 100 sort of cells within your distribution, like a histogram of 100 points. But it'd give you a shape of the probability that that parameter is in any one of those 100 different places, which is what you want. So you could then start to say, well, you know, look at, we ran it on this model, and you know, it was a massive peak around this one value, and the model was pretty, you know, we could find the confidence it had in that value, and it was really high. Or in another case, it might be, you know, spread out all over the place, it really didn't have a clue. And if you take the expected value across that whole distribution, you get back to exactly the same value as the regression neural network. So it's a way of taking the fitting, but also getting the network's confidence in what it's done. So I think that's a really interesting area to explore. So that's it. Thanks for bearing with me. And yeah, I'd say I think it's experimental, but I think it's sort of one example of where the world is going and things we can start to do that we haven't done in the past. So, thank you.
I think that was one of the most interesting talks I've been to personally for a while. We'll now open it up to the floor. So question and answers, please. Do remember, please, to state your name and whether you're qualified or a student.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. And thank you, Lisa and Alexander, for the great presentation. It was really insightful. I have two questions for Lisa, and I'll shoot both of those one by one. The first one is about the fact that on the data privacy that you mentioned, there's clearly a challenge there. But if the reason, I mean, the insight also mentioned that people are open to share their data with their doctors, and the reason obviously being that they say a personal merit in it, getting better diagnosis through it. So why don't insurance companies like yourself and your competitors come up with plans which encourage and motivate people by giving them discounts on their premium, provided they walk 10,000 steps in a day, they burn out X number of calories in a day, and at the end of it, there is a reward by giving them discounts on their premium. So are insurance companies thinking on those lines? If not, why? Because there I see a huge merit as to I, as a personal user, would definitely love you to track all my data points, provided I'm able to get a discount at the end of the day. So that's question one. And question number two is around healthcare industry has actually gone through, or personal healthcare has actually evolved through a lot of stages. At some point in time, there was a philosophy that the more you exercise and the more you work, the better fit you are. It later on changed to what you eat is what you are. These days, the latest philosophy is what you think is what you are. So while through all the IoT data and my healthcare data, what companies can really capture is what I'm eating, what I'm doing, but they will still not be able to capture what I'm thinking, what my stress levels are, how my mental health really is, which actually supposedly be influencing my physical health in a great way. So any thoughts around that?
Sure. Thanks for your question. I didn't catch your name.
My name is Deepika Goel. I'm a student member of IFA.
Perfect. You don't need to miss out on your potential chance to win some champagne later on. Cool. Yeah, thanks for those two great questions. I suppose take them one by one, or they might merge together in the answer. But I suppose your first question was around if we can sort of, as from a health insurance point of view, incentivize people to be healthier or give people discounted premiums, either if they just want to share your data or if they're doing healthy activities. So I think there are some health insurers in the market sort of doing that, but I suppose it doesn't necessarily lend itself as well to something like PMI. So PMI is quite a short-term product. So you might see that, you know, you could invest a lot in improving the health of your policyholder, and then they could potentially move to the competition. So it's not, might be better suited for something like a longer-term product potentially, like IP. But also, at the moment, quantifying that benefit is quite difficult. So you could potentially give something like a discount to people if they're willing to share their data. But my understanding of the market at the moment is that we don't have that sophisticated data set in place. We haven't had that in place for long enough. You can then start to link that discount to the person's health over the longer term. Things like chronic conditions, so you mentioned physical activity, for example, going to gyms, those would all be linked to chronic conditions, which quite a few are excluded under PMI policies. Some chronic conditions often excluded, but also it's going to take a long time to get those data sets. So I think maybe rather than putting the onus only on insurers to sort of collect that data and maybe, you know, start to track that, I think it might lend itself also to sort of wider sort of health systems, you know, potential sort of government trying to intervene or researchers as well. So I think you need collaboration with everyone. So it shouldn't just be the insurer, but they're going to need to collaborate with other players in the health service as well, because it's really a long-term game. Obviously, it would be great to make everyone healthier, and if you can incentivize people to do that, that's great, but you have to think, got to do it in the right way, so you can't just say, oh, we'll give you a discount if you go to the gym every day, sort of once a week for the next year, because once that offer ends, you might no longer want to go to the gym, because that wasn't like an intrinsic motivator for you, you were just doing it for the discount on your PMI. So you almost need to sort of help educate people and help people understand the value of the benefits of actually living a healthier lifestyle in terms of better health benefits for themselves, rather than necessarily sort of extrinsically motivating, so to speak, with these sort of external rewards and discounts. So and that's my personal view on that. And then in terms of I guess your second one, I wrote down data brokers as sort of collating all that data together. So I suppose that you couldn't necessarily know what you're thinking just by collecting your data. So that's quite interesting. So I suppose I have come across like an app in a pilot phase that can actually tell your mental state just by the way you interact with your mobile phone. So if you're sort of maybe slow to react or using different apps or just whatever you do with your phone, they're sort of this sort of startup is trying to analyze how people interact with their phone to correlate that with, for example, their mental health state. So I think you could get to a position where you could actually understand quite a lot about a person just by tracking the way they use their phone or by monitoring the way someone walks around a room, for example, their posture. I think it would be possible to do that. Whether that would be sort of desirable for society to have that kind of level of monitoring, potentially not. You could start to get, you know, quite a large data broker market where people are going to start to sort of aggregate that data together and sell it on, which you can't do in a market like the UK. But I think my understanding is in the Chinese health market, you're starting to have quite a lot of data aggregators and data brokers there that are sort of packaging that information to sell on. And maybe, I guess that can be sometimes beneficial for the individual if they can get access to better healthcare, but it might not always be desirable. But yeah, we might one day be able to tell what someone's thinking just by the way that they sort of press a button on their mobile phone, potentially.
Hiya. My name is Satya. I'm a student member. My previous background is data mining, predictive analytics, but now I'm working in the actuarial environment. My issue is when I work in before these open source tools implemented or even, you know, started to use in here, I used to use tools that's like industry standard tools to do the analysis and predictive modeling. But now I find it's difficult to use open source tools. So my question is there any like a kind of security or threshold level available for insurance companies to say like you can go up to this level and use the data and there is no, you know, need for worries or anything? Because especially after GDPR, there is so much restriction in terms of using these open tools. So my question is around, is there any like, you know, industry approved or standard level security available for these type of companies? It's a question for any of you, sorry.
I can talk to it from from General Insurance or from, I work at a broker, so I can give it some context on how we're thinking about that. So we're obviously working with sort of with client data, confidential client data, and so on. And I think that for us the issue has been less around the tools, so less around sort of, you know, how we analyse the data, but more around the infrastructure, the environment we create, where we contain the data, and how we lock it down, and how we secure it. And especially as we're, I suppose, transitioning more and more into sort of a cloud type environment. So, you know, with AWS and Azure and places like that, where you can very quickly on demand pull down, you know, powerful servers and powerful tools and that kind of thing. But essentially all your data is sitting somewhere else in the cloud. And then there's just security questions around how you access it, how you, you know, if you're working from home, how do you run your query in the cloud with confidential client data? So, you know, the logistics of that, and it's, it gets quite involved, and I think it's actually relevant for actuaries, because I feel, especially when you're trying to take it to the next step and then want to productionize something, and actually use it, you know, maybe in real time or anything like that, you're going to be getting into conversations with development teams that sort of require you to actually know a bit about this stuff, a bit about like how the cloud might work and how systems talk to each other and stuff that we don't necessarily know anything about, but we probably need a basic level of understanding to be able to engage in those conversations. I'd say, I think for me it seems to be less about the tools. That, to a certain extent, you know, you might make mistakes with your analysis, but that's a sort of another issue. But if you're worrying about the sort of security aspects and then it's containing the data, but in a way that makes it usable and that you can actually get work with it.
Yeah, I'll probably just add on to a bit of a plug for our data science member interest groups. I'm co-chairing the regulation and ethics workstream. So those sort of questions, you know, the sorts of things we're starting to think about there. So, you know, try to maybe produce some guidance or a checklist of things that you can start to think about, maybe if you want to use, for example, an open source tool to start to do some machine learning and some data work. So I think it's a really big challenge, particularly in an environment like GDPR, you know, and to making sure that your data is secure. I think you're right, as actuaries, you know, we definitely want to make sure everything's very secure. So I think, you know, working with, I guess, being part of a health insurer, you know, you can work with the IT teams there to make sure that you've got that secure environment to work with. Or I suppose if you just want to start to test out a model in the health and care space, you have quite a lot of national statistics, publicly available data sets that you can start to use for that as well. So I suppose it depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. But I think we definitely have to recognise that that is a big challenge. And so, yeah, we're starting to think about that through our data science member interest group as well.
Any further?
Hiya. So I've got a question for Alexander. I work in the Lloyd's market, and I find that it seems like this kind of thing is quite kind of, it's easy to understand how that it might apply in personal lines where there's a lot of data. But in the Lloyd's market where it's more about personal relationships and less data and kind of more people's view of how things interact, I wonder how this type of work might, what your experiences are of how this might be able to help us working in the Lloyd's market.
Yep. No, great question. I mean, I work in the Lloyd's market as well, so we're a wholesale broker, and we don't do personal lines, really. So this is all, I suppose everything I'm doing is sort of targeting that specialty Lloyd's world. But what I say is, yeah, it is quite different, and depending especially as well on the class of business. Some, you know, you go to the marine world, I'd say it's probably one of the most traditional and they haven't perhaps advanced as far in some of the pricing as some of, say, property where you've had like RMS and models that have done a lot of work to kind of move things along. But I guess what I'm finding that we're getting traction with when we put it in front of clients and markets and so on, is actually a lot around like data visualization. So not even so much this sort of thing, but much more, literally things like taking some of our traditional models and maybe a traditional pricing model, a Monte Carlo model or something, but putting it online and make it opening it up and making it much more visual and easy to understand. Or mapping, a lot of stuff on risk mapping. We've been doing a lot of work on overlaying exposures on wildfire footprints and pulling data from different government agencies in the US to be able to put like wildfire footprints together in real time. So it's not so much directly in coming up to a price, but it's all part of the bigger picture around the risk management and so on. This kind of thing, I'd say, you know, I think there is a space for it, probably slightly more behind the scenes. I don't think anyone's going to get too excited about it, as long as you can prove it's a good method. If you could use it, I was trying to curve some energy claims and got frustrated with having to rely on sort of traditional parametric distribution, so I wanted to do something that would help me a bit with that. So that was kind of aimed at the world where you might have quite a few small attritional claims, but just one or two very big claims, and we're forever coming up with judgment to try to fit curves to it. So having a way to take some of that judgment out of my hands and have a bit more method around it. Exactly, yeah, just to sort of augment it. And I suppose bringing an element of consistency, because if at least you've got sort of one method which you can understand how the method works and you can explain it and you can use it on all your different problems, and rather than having three actuaries looking at different problems and coming up with different picks every time, it might not be the best way, but maybe you can enforce some kind of consistency there. But it's a work in progress.
Any further questions? Tanya?
Hi, I'm Gerard Farmer. I'm a qualified member. I wondered if there was potential for prejudice to be encoded into machine learning. So for, sexist or other prejudices to be encoded in machine learning and the models.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a concern. So I guess I don't know how familiar everyone is with some quite high profile examples. So I think Microsoft built a machine learning algorithm for hiring, and then that was turned out to not be like a fair hiring method, because obviously they're just sort of recruiting the same people that they had already recruited in the past. You don't get diversity. So it's definitely right to think that when you're building an algorithm, is it going to be ethical? Is it going to be fair as part of that? So I guess you need to be really aware of that when you start to develop your models. You might want to potentially have some sort of sample data that is a broader data set to train from, so to make sure that you don't just focus in on a specific subset of people. You might want to broaden out your sample data or use some dummy data just to sort of increase the diversity within your data set. But it's definitely a big thing to be aware of when you're developing a model, in that what's gone on in the past you might just be amplifying that. So I think, it's really important as a profession that we're aware of that and that we sort of take steps to overcome that. And even if you've got the best fit in the world, it's still the outcome that you see might not be, desirable from an ethical point of view. So I think we really need to, when you start to do a machine learning project, think what would a fair, equal outcome look like, recognize those inherent biases maybe within your training data set, and think what steps that you can take to overcome that as well.
Yeah, just to add to that slightly, I think it's actually a huge opportunity for us as actuaries, that this kind of aspect, because it's becoming easier and easier to sort of just, for anybody to basically start to fit things and use some of these powerful tools. But with our domain knowledge and understanding these issues and looking out for them, I think that's where we can sort of still be highly relevant in this sort of new world.
Okay, Katie Hicks. I'm a student. I'm glad you mentioned domain knowledge there. My question's not about that, though. So a charity that I support has been flagging issues in Yemen for well over 2 years, but yet the bigger problem is not recognizing that there's famine and cholera outbreaks. It's the funding. You mentioned helping stakeholders to use the models. I wonder if you might comment a little bit more about how you think maybe this could, one thing I can see is if vaccination is cheaper than cure, which I would think it is, then you're targeting resources more effectively. But is there anything else that we as actuaries can maybe do in that sort of space that helps when there are resource constraints, as there always are?
Great question, thank you. So I think, that example that I showed with the cholera outbreaks, I guess it shows the power of maybe taking some sort of data sets that might be publicly available, things like the weather forecast data. You can get quite a lot of global data sets on weather patterns and things like that. So, there might be a lot of publicly available data sources that people could start to use in order to potentially build some of these models that could address some of those needs. So you might not necessarily need to invest a lot of money and resources in developing a particular model. If you wanted to crowdsource a particular project, there would be forums like Kaggle, for example, where you could post your problem online and you could start to actually crowdsource a solution. And you'll hopefully find a lot of passionate people that will want to solve these really important and pressing challenges. I think you can see just the power that can be done if you're able to, for example, use something like weather forecast data that we've had accessible for a long time. You can use that for epidemic forecasting. I think I've got another example in sort of Ebola outbreaks, during that time when they were quite high. You could actually use mobile phone location data to actually track the spread of Ebola over time as well. And you could potentially respond to that, so you could limit the spread of population if you think people moving in a certain way is going to really heighten your outbreak. So I think there's a lot more we can do in that space in terms of epidemic forecasting globally in order to not only just predict the epidemic but also help to sort of react to that and target aid in the right places as well, definitely.
Thank you. My question is for Lisa. Thank you for digging out all the examples in your talk. One thing I personally would like a bit more clarity on is, in your examples, exactly what measure is trying to be predicted in those cases? So, for example, are you trying to predict, say, out of a population of whatever, what proportion will go to hospital, contract a certain disease? Or are you trying to predict length of hospital stays? I wasn't quite clear exactly what measure you're trying to predict. So if you could explain, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, sure. I think, I suppose each example will have its own different measure. So I suppose the first example, the Australian health system example, so that was focused purely on predicting when people are going to arrive to hospital. So out of the local population, what proportion are going to present, and then to stratify that by the particular sort of age and gender profiles and the different condition types. So really getting as much detail as possible in there. There's a similar model that's been done in France where they didn't have access to cause of admission, but they were still able to just predict the pure number of arrivals at hospitals. So even if you don't have the most extensive data source, you can still build quite a useful model in terms of knowing how many people are actually going to turn up to the hospital. So that wasn't particularly around length of stay, it's just around numbers of people presenting to the health system. I suppose the cholera one, I think you could see in the video, there was predicting from 0 to 1, like the risk of cholera outbreak. So they had like a heat map on there that was sort of mapped to the cholera outbreak risk score. I don't know, was there any other particular example that you wanted more clarity on, or the high-level example at the end, which were the other ones? Cool. Perfect. Yeah, I suppose it just depends on the particular problem. So you'd obviously want to define your specific measure up front that you want to measure, and then you can work from there to actually build your example. So I suppose they're quite high-level examples. They were each predicting something slightly different in each case based on the particular scenario. If you're trying to do your own model, you'd want to be really clear about exactly what the objective of your model is. So I think the one at the end, you might just want to predict actual numbers of people arriving at hospital. That's quite a generic measure that's sort of quite high level. It might be a good starting point before you then go down and actually sort of subdivide that into the particular different condition types and sort of age and gender profiles and things like that.
Good time for one more question.
Thank you. So you're going head-to-head against non-actuarial data scientists, and I just wanted to know, you know, what strengths do you think we have compared with non-actuaries in the data scientist world?
Okay. Well, I guess I'd start with domain knowledge, which I think is our big thing. So we work in finance, we work in insurance. I guess, you know, the data scientists would go across the industry. So they might work this week, we'll do some image recognition. Next week, we'll go to video. Maybe we'll do some work in finance next month. But they're not, they're dipping in and out. Whereas we've been sort of in insurance forever, and that's the bit that we know, and we understand the intricacies and the issues around it. So I think if we can modernize and we can learn to adopt some of the new techniques, I think we're strategically perfectly positioned, and the sort of a lot of the hype around being a data scientist and so on is probably going to pass, and people will want people that, or employers will want people that really understand this stuff. So that quality, I think if we can maintain that, then I don't really see it as a, I think there's just a lot we can learn, but I don't think there's necessarily a lot of a big threat there after all.
And so I just add, as well as branching out into all these new areas and maybe sort of competing, so to speak, with data scientists, I think we're quite, well, obviously best placed to solve actuarial problems. So obviously we know our industry better than anyone else, you would think. So I think, we could focus a lot of effort on trying to use data science to solve actuarial specific problems, maybe in life or pensions and other financial services as well. So yeah, it's very exciting to think we could branch off into sort of a lot of new industries, but I wouldn't overlook sort of the value that we can bring using data science to solve our actuarial specific problems as well.
And just sorry, one final thing to add, say we can't be complacent. If we're complacent as a profession and we don't really move to sort of understand this stuff as a profession as a whole, really build it into our exam system, then that's a different question, and we probably won't be relevant. But if, as long as we can become skilled in this, then no reason why we can become thrive.
Thank you very much for your participation. I've got a tough job to find the winner. So the lady who mentioned what you think is what you are, so it's a Deepika, a student member. The other one was around prejudice in machine learning. I think should always be, being ethical and fair should always be a consideration. So the gentleman there has won it. So that's the winners. Just to remind you that there's the online survey which will be emailed to you soon. Please do complete that. There'll be networking drinks just outside the hall. Please do stay. The speakers will be staying for a bit. And all that remains is to thank the speakers once more, please.